You're listening to The Truth Podcast from PursueGod.org.
When we look at the Middle East on the evening news, or, you know, when we hear about geopolitical conflicts in Iraq or Iran or Saudi Arabia, Western minds tend to view it through a purely political or even an economic lens. You know, we think it's just about oil or borders or, you know, ayatollahs or whatever. But beneath the surface of this political landscape, there's an ancient, deep, profoundly theological fracture. It's a fracture that dates back to the year 632 AD, to a single room in the city of Medina, where the prophet Muhammad took his final breath. Today we're talking about the division between Sunni and Shia Muslims. To the average outsider, Islam looks like this really big monolithic block of, you know, uniform belief. We see billions of people turning toward Mecca five times a day, fasting during the month of Ramadan, you know, or reading the exact same text of the Quran. And from a distance, that corporate unity looks pretty solid, pretty absolute. But if you zoom in, you find a massive chasm. It's a chasm that has shaped empires and fueled civil wars. It's defined modern nations. And it really has altered the spiritual lives of over a billion people today. Today, as we take a look at this 1,400-year-old argument over Muhammad's successor, we're not just going to be covering a history lesson. We're going to dive deep into the origin of the split, yes. We're going to explore the bloody turning point, of course. But really what we're going to do is compare these two massive ideologies. And we're not just going to compare them to each other, but we're also going to compare them to, you know, how splits have happened in the Christian faith over the years. So let's talk about the difference between Sunni and Shia Muslims. To understand the split, we have to travel back to the hot, dusty streets of Medina in the year 632 AD. So for 23 years, Muhammad had basically functioned not just as a religious teacher, but really as a total leader. He was the prophet who received what Muslims believed to be the literal, uncreated words of Allah. He was the chief justice who settled legal disputes. He was the commander-in-chief of the armies that unified the entire Arabian Peninsula. So he was the political head of state. He was the original warlord of all warlords. Now remember, in Islam, there was no separation of church and state because the state was the vehicle of faith. And so religion, law, governance, military strategy, they were all woven into one single garment, basically. But then in 632 AD, Muhammad dies. And now all of a sudden, the revelation stops. The divine pipeline that had guided every major civic and spiritual decision for over two decades goes completely silent. So think about it. The community is left in a state of absolute paralyzed shock. Muhammad had transformed a collection of fractured, warring tribal factions into a unified religious empire, but he died without leaving a surviving son. And crucially, he died without explicitly laying down a clear, universally accepted mechanism for how the next leader should be chosen, or the next one after that, or the next one after that. So think about the sheer weight of that vacuum. It's a crisis of massive proportions. If the community breaks apart now, the entire movement dies in the Arabian desert, and we wouldn't be talking about Islam today. Two distinct philosophies immediately collided in that vacuum, and those two philosophies became the structural pillars of Sunni, that's one, and Shia, that's number two. These are the two major types of Islam today. So let's look at the first group, which would eventually become the Sunni branch. The word Sunni comes from the word sunnah, which means tradition or custom or the example of the prophet. The majority of Muhammad's close companions looked at the crisis and they argued from a position of pragmatic communal preservation. So they believed that while Muhammad's prophetic role was unique and could never be replaced, his political and administrative roles had to be filled by someone who could handle the job, right? So they argued that the leader should be elected or selected through shura, a process of consultation among the leading elders of the community. They didn't believe that the leader needed to be a supernatural figure or a physical, biological relative of the prophet. He just needed to be a capable guardian of the tradition. This majority group ended up choosing a guy named Abu Bakr. He was Muhammad's closest friend, his father-in-law, actually, through his marriage to Aisha, and the man Muhammad had appointed to lead public prayers when he became too ill to do it himself. Abu Bakr became the first caliph, the word derived from the Arabic khalifa, which literally means successor or deputy. For Sunnis, the legitimacy of the caliph rested on the consensus of the community and his adherence to the established sunnah. So that was the beginning of the Sunni branch, but there was a minority voice in that room, and this voice was completely drowned out at the time, but they refused to be silenced. This group, over time, became known as the Shi'at Ali, the partisans of Ali, which over time was shortened to what we know now as Shia Muslims. The Shias looked at the election of Abu Bakr and viewed it as nothing short of a political coup, a betrayal of a divine intent. They argued that leadership over the Muslim community wasn't an administrative job that could be put to vote by a bunch of tribal elders. They thought that spiritual authority was a divine thing, you know, like a sacred right that could only be transmitted through the sacred bloodline of the Prophet Muhammad himself. And since Muhammad had no surviving sons, the focus shifted to his family, the people of the house. Now, specifically, they looked at Ali ibn Abi Talib. Ali was Muhammad's first cousin. He was raised in Muhammad's household. He was one of the very first converts to Islam, and he was married to Muhammad's daughter, Fatima. They shared a physical bloodline through their grandchildren, Hassan and Hussein. The Shias maintained that during his lifetime, particularly at a place called Ghadir Qum, during his first pilgrimage, Muhammad had explicitly laid his hands on Ali and designated him as his spiritual and political successor. So to the Shia mind, selecting Abu Bakr based on political consensus was basically an act of human arrogance and overrode the divine appointment that they believed that Muhammad had already set up. To unpack this further, we need to look at the deep-seated cultural differences and how these two groups understood the nature of human authority. For the Sunnis, the caliph was a historical political executive, right? He was responsible for enforcing Sharia law, protecting the borders of the empire, and ensuring the stability of the community. He was a man, totally fallible, who could be rebuked or removed if he violated the law, right? He was just an appointed leader. But for the Shias, the leader, whom they called the Imam, is something way more spiritual and mystical and important. In Shia theology, the Imam isn't just a political ruler. He's a divinely inspired spiritual guide. So he possesses isma, the quality of infallibility and freedom from sin. The Shia believe that the outer text of the Quran has an inner, esoteric, hidden meaning, and only the divinely appointed imam from the bloodline of the prophet has the supernatural insight required to interpret that hidden meaning. So this fracture goes deep, right? It's not just a disagreement over a ballot box in 632 AD. It's a fundamental disagreement over how God communicates with humanity after the close of Revelation, because Sunnis and Shias, neither one of them believe that there was another prophet after Muhammad. He was the ultimate and greatest prophet. But they're left there arguing, is authority decentralized? Does it rest on the consensus of scholars reading traditions? Or is it centralized, resting on a living, divinely inspired, infallible human lineage? So eventually, history forced a temporary compromise. Abu Bakr ruled for a couple of years, and then There was a second caliph named Umar and a third caliph named Uthman. And then finally, 24 years after the death of Muhammad, Ali was finally selected as the fourth caliph. So for a brief moment, the Shias believed the rightful order had been restored. But Ali's reign was plagued by civil war. There was a lot of structural instability. There were tribal rivalries. So in 661 AD, while praying in the great mosque of Kufa in modern-day Iraq, Ali was assassinated by a radical extremist group who was caught up in the debate. And so with Ali's death, the political center of gravity shifted away from Medina and Mecca to Damascus, where there was a powerful secular-leaning dynasty called the Umayyads, and they seized control of the caliphate. So this set the stage for the definitive blood-soaked turning point that would tear the fabric of Islam apart forever. And this is what really transformed a political debate into an emotional, theological religion of martyrdom. This is where we have to understand the slaughter at Karbala. Okay, fast forward 19 years to the year 680 AD. The Umayyad Caliph has died. His son has claimed the throne in Damascus. And this guy, his son Yazid, was viewed by most pious Muslims, actually both Sunni and Shia, as corrupt, tyrannical. He was a guy who treated the caliphate like a personal family kingdom rather than a sacred trust. So he demands an oath of absolute allegiance from every major leader across the empire. Now, down in Medina, Hussein ibn Ali, the son of Ali, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, refuses to bow. To Hussein, taking an oath of allegiance to a corrupt tyrant like Yazid would be a complete betrayal of everything that his grandfather has built. He receives frantic letters from the citizens of Kufa, a city in Iraq that had been loyal to his father Ali, and they tell him, hey, come to Iraq. We have no leader. We'll pledge our lives to you. Stand up against the tyranny of Damascus, and we're going to back you. And so Hussein gathers a little band of followers, about 72 guys, along with his wives, sisters, and small children. They set off across the burning desert toward Iraq. It's a journey born of deep religious conviction. You know, he believes that the true spiritual lineage of Islam must stand up and confront political corruption. But as Hussein approaches Iraq, Yazid's governor intercepts him. And the political winds of Kufa have shifted. The people have been terrified into submission by the arrival of a massive Umayyad army, and the promises of military backing evaporate into the desert air. So Hussein and his little family circle are surrounded in the plains at a place called Karbala, right next to the Euphrates River. The Umayyad army, which numbered in the thousands, they cut off their access to the river, and for days, in the blistering heat of the desert, Hussein's family, including infants and young children, are systematically starved of water. Now, on the 10th day of the Islamic month of Muharram, a day known today as Ashura, the final slaughter begins. Hussein's men fight bravely, but they're overwhelmed, of course. One by one, Hussein watches his brothers, his cousins, his own sons cut down before his eyes. And so finally, covered in wounds, holding the body of his infant son who'd been pierced through the neck by an arrow, Hussein himself is brutally killed. His body is trampled by horses, his head is severed from his torso and sent on a silver platter to Yazid in Damascus as a trophy of war. I know it's brutal, but this is the story. And it is impossible to overstate the psychological and theological impact of the Battle of Karbala on Shia Islam. Now, for Sunnis, Karbala is a deeply tragic historical event. They revere Hussein as a noble martyr. They recognize that he's a member of the Prophet's family. They condemn his killers. But for Sunnis, it's just a historical tragedy within the framework of political history. For Shias, though, Karbala is the cosmic axis of their entire faith, right? It transformed Shia Islam from a political faction backing Ali's lineage into a profound spiritual ideology centered on suffering and systemic injustice and redemptive martyrdom. Think about the psychological trauma of the event. The grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, You know, the man who the prophet used to carry on his shoulders was left to die of thirst in the desert, slaughtered by the very army that claimed to represent Islam. See, the Shia world was consumed by an overwhelming sense of guilt and grief. They felt that they had failed to protect the Holy Family. And so every single year on the day of Asherah, millions of Shia Muslims around the world take to the streets in massive, emotionally raw processions of public mourning. They wear black, they weep, they chant elegies, and in some traditional contexts, men practice takbir, striking their chests or flagellating their backs with chains or blades to physically connect with the physical pain and thirst that Hussein experienced on that day all those years ago. The mantra of Karbala for Shia Muslim is simple. Every day is Asherah and every land is Karbala. It means that life is a permanent cosmic struggle between the oppressed and the oppressor. The true believer is called to stand with the broken and the martyred against the corrupt structures of the world. See, maybe you're starting to understand Shia Islam a little bit better now, because this historical event is what shapes the way Shia and Sunni Muslims operate today. In a decentralized model of authority, they don't have a single pope-like figure. Instead, authority is distributed among scholars, legal experts, university faculties, and these are the people who interpret the Quran and the Hadith through consensus. Sunnis represent about 85 to 90% of the global Muslim population. They're the vast majority in countries like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Indonesia, Turkey, and Pakistan. Shias, on the other hand, make up about 10 to 15% of the global Muslim population. And they, as you can imagine, developed a highly rigid hierarchy out of sheer necessity to survive centuries of persecution under Sunni empires. Most Shias belong to a branch called the Twelvers. They believe that after Ali and Hussein, there was a succession of 12 divine imams. They believe the 12th imam, a child named Muhammad al-Mahdi, was supernaturally hidden by God in the year 874 AD to protect his life. He's known as the hidden imam. Shia theology teaches that he is still alive. He exists in a state of supernatural occultation, and he's going to return at the very end of human history alongside Jesus to destroy tyranny and establish absolute justice on earth. But notice what happens when your ultimate spiritual leader is hidden for over 1,000 years. Who runs the world in his absence? The Shia solution was to create a highly organized class of senior religious scholars who act as general deputies for the hidden imam. They're called the Ayatollahs, a title that literally means sign of God. Because these Ayatollahs are seen as the mouthpieces of the infallible hidden imam, they wield a level of absolute spiritual, financial, and political authority over their followers that has no equivalent at all in the Sunni world. So, for example, when Ayatollah Khomeini launched the Iranian Revolution in 1979, he wasn't just pulling off a political coup, he was tapping into centuries of dormant Shia theology, right? He was calling the people to rise up against a secular westernized dictator in the name of the martyred Hussein and the coming hidden imam. Today, this division creates a massive geopolitical fault line through the heart of the Middle East. I mean, think about the proxy war between Saudi Arabia, the absolute champion of Sunni Islam, and Iran, the undisputed heavyweight of Shia Islam. Every conflict in the region, from the civil war in Syria to the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen, is deepened and weaponized by political leaders who exploit these deep, ancient religious identity markers to rally their populations to war. Now, how does this connect to Christianity? I mean, honestly, over the millennia, we've had our own splits. We've had our own wars and disputes. But I think a fitting verse to end with is 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 12 and 13. Paul writes, "Some of you are saying, I'm a follower of Paul. Others are saying, I follow Apollos, or I follow Peter, or I follow only Christ." And Paul says, "Has Christ been divided into factions?" He says, "Was I, Paul, crucified for you?" Paul is exposing the absolute absurdity of tribalism. He's saying that the moment you try to slice up the body of Christ into competing human camps, you're acting as if Christ himself could be chopped into pieces. You know, the moment you build your ultimate spiritual identity around a human leader, and I know that some Christians still do this today, be it Catholic or Protestant, but as soon as you elevate a flawed human being into a space that belongs to Jesus and Jesus only, you've got something that is not biblical Christianity. So the Sunni-Shia split is anchored in this unresolvable historic conflict over who has the legitimate human right to interpret the law and rule the empire. You know, it's a system built on human lines of succession, but historic biblical Christianity is just way simpler than all of that. Jesus didn't leave behind a vacant corporate boardroom for his disciples to fight over. He didn't leave a political office that needed a successor. When Jesus hung on the cross, he cried out, "It's finished." The debt was paid. The temple curtain was torn. The path into the holy presence of God was thrown wide open. And not just for a specific family line or an elite class of religious scholars, but for every single human being who puts their faith in him. When we look at the life and the teachings of Jesus, we see a king who steps off of the tribal grid that so many religions get caught up in. And unlike the teachings of Islam, the message of Christianity is a simple call to follow one man who is also fully God. His name is Jesus.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to share this episode with a friend. Find more resources to talk about these topics with your small group, family, or mentor on pursuegod.org.